session after lunch, Redressing America, Civil Liberties, and Social Justice Activism in Post-World War II. Apologies for starting a little bit late. And at this point, I'd like to introduce Dr. Mitchell Maki, who is going to moderate the panel.
Thank you. Well, welcome to this afternoon's panel. We have a very exciting panel for you here today. And I think to many of you in the audience, you may recognize the three individuals to my left. They are people who need no introduction in the Japanese-American community and certainly not in the redress community. We're very excited to have them here today to share their personal reflections and thoughts about the meaning and legacy of Japanese-American redress. Granted, we have about an hour now, an hour and 15 minutes to get through this panel. And as I look around the audience, I see people in the audience that were people who made the movement happen and know a great deal about the movement. And I know there are others in the audience who know very little about the movement and want basic information. So we're going to do our best to make everybody happy and entertain those who know a great deal about redress as well as those who are just learning about it today. Let me take this opportunity to very quickly introduce the three individuals. We have John Tateishi, Aiko Herzog Yoshinaga, and Alan Nishio. Let me tell you a little bit about them. Mr. John Tateishi, to my far left, was the chair of the Japanese American Citizens League National Committee for Redress. In the 1970s, the JACL was the oldest Asian American civil rights organization. And in his role as LEC director, Mr. Tateishi helped to direct the JACL to undertake the challenge of fighting for redress and in deciding to pursue the creation of a federal commission to study the problem. To his right is Aiko Herzog Yoshinaga, who has been referred to as the backbone of the redress movement. Truly, she was a major player. But am I right, Kate? Am I right? Okay, so truly she was a major player in providing the research that propelled the Coram Nobis cases that we heard Dale Manami speak about this morning and the NCJAR class action suit. Her research informed the members of the Blue Ribbon Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, which issued the recommendation for a presidential apology and monetary redress payments. To her right is Mr. Alan Nishio. Mr. Nishio played a significant role in the NCRR, the National Coalition for Redress and Reparations. The NCRR was a grassroots organization that offered a large part of the Japanese-American community that was not involved with the redress movement an opportunity to get involved and contribute to the movement. In 1987, the NCRR organized the largest ever Asian-American lobbying trip to Washington, D.C. that was attended by over 100 Japanese-American community activists. So these are our panelists today. Let's go ahead and start off, and I first thank you for joining us. The first question that I'd like to ask, and we'll go ahead and start with John, is why did you get involved in redress? And in the beginning of the movement, did you really think that an apology and redress payments were possible?
Thank you. The reason I got involved with redress, let me start with that, is it goes way back to the end of the war, World War II, and our departure from Manzanar, where my family had been. And as we were leaving, my father said to my brothers and me that he said, never forget this place. And someday, if you have an opportunity to make it right, you must do so. And I remember growing up feeling that camp was an experience that really shaped so much of my life, as well as the years after the war. And after my wife and I had lived in London for a few years and had returned to the Bay Area, got involved with the JACL, and through Edison Uno, who was a friend, started getting more involved with redress. My only interest with JACL, quite frankly, was because of redress. There was discussion in the organization from 1970 when it formally accepted a resolution for reparations. And I had kind of watched what was going on in those discussions. It was evolving, but it wasn't really getting anywhere that very far, because in those days, the community was so split on the issue, whether we should even try something or just leave the past alone. And so I got involved more deeply involved with JECL because of the redress campaign, the redress discussions going on. It was something I knew from the time I was a kid and through my teenage years that someday I would be involved in something that tried to rectify that wrong. The question about what the JECL did, in fact, we launched the campaign from here in Salt Lake up the road in Salt Lake City at the 1978 convention where S.I. Hayakawa was a keynote speaker. I had no idea how he got invited to speak at a JECL convention. He knew what we were going to be talking about, which was the Salt Lake City guidelines, $25,000 individual payments, a trust fund, and an apology. And he gave a keynote speech and said of the $25,000, it was absurd and ridiculous. I had been asked to take the chairmanship of the JECL's Redress Committee, the National Redress Committee, which I gladly did. And in anticipation of what Hayakawa was going to be doing, I had issued a press release saying that Hayakawa was absurd and ridiculous in his thinking. And we went to battle with the senator for the next few months in the media. And I launched this as a public education campaign, mainly because I realized that in most places around the country, people had no idea that the internment had ever occurred, that most of the people who knew something about it thought it was the right thing to have happened, and that people just didn't understand it. Plus, Japanese Americans really didn't understand the internment. So there was a real need for us to educate ourselves and educate the public. When I launched the campaign, to be honest, my goal was to try to educate the public. I thought if we accomplish that, that would be the most important thing, because the money really didn't matter. The apology was important. And I really didn't know if we'd ever get $25,000. I mean, I just thought that was such a huge goal for us to try to achieve. But, you know, we believed in it. I believed in it. I didn't know that we'd be able to succeed. I didn't even know if we'd get a bill in the Congress, but within 2 years, we had a bill that had passed, the bill that created the Federal Commission. Once that bill was in the process of being approved, I really, because I was in D.C. a lot lobbying that bill, I mean, that was my role, I realized that redress was a real possibility. It was the first time that I thought there was a possibility that we could actually do this, that as small as we were as a community, and as insignificant in this country as we were, that it was a real possibility that we could do this. I knew we would be able to educate the public. There was no question in my mind about that. But in terms of the overall goal, achieving redress, you know, it wasn't until 1980 that I thought this is a real possibility. And, you know, in another 8 years, that's what we were able to achieve.
Aiko, how about you? When did you get involved? What were your feelings? Did you think an apology and redress were possible?
Well, it's really been a truly great educational experience for me, and a real adventure to have been involved in so many different important activities throughout the Japanese American redress movement, to have the government remedy the grievances that we had against it. For me, it was really exciting to be able to see through archival research of at the National Archives all those government letters and memos and reports and telephone transcriptions which related to the Professor Muller calls our eviction and subsequent incarceration for those of us who lived on the West Coast. And it was a personally immense interest to me because I was one of those uprooted and forced to spend 3 years in three different camps. I happened to be in Manzanar and Jerome and then Roer. The best part of that period when I was doing all this research was the opportunity that was given to me to meet and get to know and to establish warm relationships with the many hardworking, dedicated, committed Japanese Americans and a bunch of non-Japanese Americans throughout the country as a result of all the research that I did and the studies that Mitch had mentioned I was involved in included being the researcher for the National for the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, for the Coram Nobis cases, Korematsu Hirobayashi and Yasui, for the National Council for Japanese American Redress, NCJAR, and I was honored to help the Justice Department, the Office of the Redress Administration, to try to locate every single eligible Japanese American for redress. And it was very exciting even to find one name that has slipped through the cracks, which became a person who became eligible to receive the compensation and the apology by the government, actually the president. But before I go much further, I really want to mention that I think a lot of our success would not have been possible without the kind of leadership that we had, beginning with the Special Counsel for the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, who was Angus Macbeth. Now, he and his wonderful editorial staff pulled together all the research that we had done and the evidence to show that the government had indeed made a big mistake and violated our constitutional rights. Angus Macbeth and his dedicated writers pulled together all the thousands and pages of evidence to prove to the Congress and to the President that they had made a big mistake to put us into these camps. And it was their work and the evidence in the Personal Justice Denied, the report, which made it possible for us to convince Congress and the President that remedy was due to all the victims of the camp life, since they had abrogated our rights, constitutional rights. It was right and meet that the government live up to its mistakes and to acknowledge by compensating the victims. The leadership of Mr. Macbeth was very important in preparing this report to Congress. I'm sure that without it, it would have been very difficult. It was hard enough to write the report, but to write it in such a way as to convince the Congress that the victims should be compensated. Then we had Dr. Tom Crouch, who was the curator of the Smithsonian Institutions and National Museum of American History, who helped to establish the exhibition at NMAH called A More Perfect Union, Japanese Americans and the United States Constitution. Now, Dr. Crouch did a marvelous job to pull together all the information about the history, the camp history, as well as pre-war racial discrimination, and the story of redress. And the exhibition was a very big exhibition and was established in October. It opened in October 1987. And it was going to be up for just a few years, but surprisingly, it was so successful, and millions of people were educated because of the exhibition that they kept it up for more than 10 years. It is now dismantled for temporarily, but it's going to be up again later this year, I understand, because the entire museum, American History Museum, is being renovated. And the AMPU, a more perfect union, our story is diminished a little bit in space, but apparently it's going to be another very good exhibition headed by Dr. Franklin Odo. I'm looking forward to being able to get over there to see the new version. Then I have a note here to myself to not to forget to mention the attorneys for the Coram Nobis cases. Those young lawyers, so dedicated, worked pro bono, and I can't begin to name them. There were so many of them, but I would just name the Korematsu lead attorney was Dale Minami. The Hirabayashi lead attorney was Rod Kawakami, and the Yasui, Men Yasui's lead attorney was Peggy Nagai. They each had a team of wonderful, very smart lawyers, and they prepared the brief, which was so successful that the convictions of these three men in the 1940s were vacated due to the wonderful brief and arguments that these pro bono, coram nobis, mostly sansei lawyers had presented before the court. So proud to have been able to work with them to help to find evidentiary documentation that led to the success in vacating their wartime convictions.
Aiko, if I can interrupt for just a second. Sure. Aiko is being very generous and very modest with her praise of others. All of the different activities that she just mentioned were due, in fact, to the evidence that she and her husband, Jack Herzig, were able to unearth from the National Archives. Aiko would actually spend many times over 60 hours a week in the National Archives doing the labor of looking through files, trying to find the various pieces of evidence. And she found the smoking guns. She found the evidence upon which the Coram Nobis cases were based, which was that the U.S. government, had knowingly and willingly withheld information from the Supreme Court that Japanese Americans posed no threat to the United States of America. This is the woman who waded through all of those boxes, who found those pieces of evidence, and if we can get to them in a few minutes, she can tell you some of the stories of how she was able to cajole people to do things, how she was able to find things and recognize them, and she has some wonderful stories about how she found things simply because she was able to recognize that it was different from all the other pieces of paper that she had been looking at previously. So Aiko, I think it's only fair that we give credit where credit is due, and certainly a lot of credit is due to you. If you can hold on to your thoughts, because I'm going to bring us up to the commission hearing in just a moment. I want to hear from Alan, and then we'll talk about the commission hearing. Alan, when did you join Redress, and when did you think it really was possible?
Well, my initial involvement with Redress was in the late 70s, right after the JCL, in fact, had passed at their national convention the resolution supporting redress and monetary payments. But in terms of my own involvement, it kind of started much earlier. Many of you that know me here, my freshman year in college was as a student at Cal Berkeley during the free speech movement. And that was an event that forever changed my life in terms of the importance of defending rights and activism. And so during my college years, was involved in that, was involved in civil rights as a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. And also, again, you know, anti-war activities against the war in Vietnam. And so I had a strong activist background that I carried into activities. And what was, in fact, one of the things that the first demonstration I organized was against the JACL. because in Los Angeles, they had invited Senator S.I. Hayakawa to be their keynote speaker. And I thought, why in the H is, is the JACL inviting S.I. Hayakawa as their keynote speaker? So we organized the demonstration, and the JACL people were like freaking out.
Was that the dinner?
This is in Anaheim. Yeah. You weren't there, were you, John?
No,
anyway,
I wasn't there.
He was one of the ones freaking out.
But I'm just letting you back. I mean, those of you that know, I'm an unrepentant activist and someone who believes in grassroots empowerment and taking these issues up from the bottom up. But what was interesting for me was I was involved in all of these struggles, etc. But it didn't click for me because, you know, the other story is I was born in Manzanar. And I didn't learn what Manzanar was until my senior year in college. I was a political science major focusing on civil rights, other kinds of things. And I just assumed Manzanar was a small town that my family happened to be in, and, you know, during World War II. And I heard about stories of camp, but I just thought it was like a migrant camp or something, you know. And I was doing research in the stacks in the library, and I ran across a one-paragraph section, you know, in this book called A Managed Casualty, that talked about Manzanar, one of 10 relocation centers in which Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. And it's the first time I'd ever seen Manzanar in print. And after I saw that, then I went home over the break and asked my parents, well, what is Manzanar? And they didn't want to talk about it. I said, don't worry about it. That's kind of history, blah, 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 blah. And so it really came out at that time in my life, being an activist, et cetera, that I had no clue about my own history and what had occurred. And so, to make a long story short, as a result of that and then my involvement in the development of ethnic studies and things of like that, I was founding staff for the Asian American Center at UCLA. It became fairly clear after the JACL resolution that redress and reparations should be the defining civil rights, civil liberties issue for the Japanese American community. And that if we were really going to, as a community, try to advance civil rights, you know, and I think Stokely Carmichael said it so well when I was a member of SNCC, saying if white people are really concerned about advancing civil rights, rather than going down to the South on buses to register black voters, they should deal with their white neighbors and deal with racism where they are and change the nature of white racism toward African Americans. And I think that hit home for me, so I said if we're going to really fight for civil rights and civil liberties as Japanese Americans, we have to define that issue in a way in which it most resonates with our own community. And if we cannot empower ourselves as a community to take this up, then we really don't have a lot going for us. So that really is what generated my own involvement in redress.
Alan, talk a little bit about the formation of the NCRR, because that happened before the commission, and then we're going to move into the commission with the three of you.
Well, as part of it, I was involved in Los Angeles in a community organization based out of Little Tokyo, the Little Tokyo People's Rights Organization. And we saw it important to take on the fight for redress, and so we worked with other organizations in different communities in San Francisco, San Jose, New York, Chicago. And because we felt it was important to fight for redress, but to be quite truthful, we wanted to work with the JACL, but not through the JACL, because we didn't trust the JACL. It'd be, you know, any group that would be inviting S.I. Hayakawa to be their speaker was not an organization that we felt. Now, I must say, in retrospect, the JACL was the core of the, you know, of the campaign for redress. And so, you know, I've told John afterwards, you know, that, you know, my suspicions and doubts were, you know, kind of allayed as the years went on. And I think in a large part of John's work, et cetera. But the JACL, during the times when we were starting the National Coalition for Redress and Reparations, the leadership was dominated by the leadership that was in the leadership of JACL during World War II. And their position relative to issues of accommodationism and patriotism and whatever was fairly clear. And so many of us did not have any confidence that the JACL would actually take up the issue. We applauded Edison Nuno and the others for passing the resolution, but I could not imagine people like Mike Masaoka and others really allowing that to happen. And so many of us, and also it was a generational issue that we perceived the JACL as largely a Nisei organization, with its focus on, you know, better Americans for a greater America, et cetera. Being a Sansei activist and the generational dynamics of that time, you know, don't trust anyone over 30, you know, was important because we felt if we were going to gain redress, it would be through grassroots organizing, and it required activism, and it required ways of doing things other than just kind of relying on the JACL and lobbying and things of that nature. So we wanted to work with the JACL, but we clearly were concerned and did not feel that that could be an organization that many of us as activists could really work through because we, quite truthfully, didn't trust the JACL and its leadership.
I think you're starting to get the picture that in the early 80s, we have the established JACL, which is the largest and oldest Asian American civil rights organization at the time, but it certainly is an organization that had its quote-unquote baggage and certainly had its detractors. In the early 80s, we also now have the development of the National Coalition for Redress and Reparations, which, as Alan so eloquently described, is a group mainly made up of young Sanse activists who are distrustful of the JACL, but who also are very committed to the issues of redress and reparations. In hindsight, many people have attributed NCRR as providing a vehicle by which new people could come into the movement. People that may have been disenchanted with the JACL could enter into the movement through the NCRR. So we start to have these two very strong organizations move forward. Yes?
A very basic question. A lot of us know what these acronyms are, but some of us do not.
Okay. Oh, yeah. JACL, Japanese American Citizens League, NCRR, National Coalition for Redress and Reparations. So again, John had the experience from JACL and Alan from the National Coalition for Redress and Reparations.
Hey, Mitch, can I just comment?
Jump in.
It's really interesting because Alan and I basically come from the same perspective. I was at Berkeley. My wife and I were at Berkeley in the 60s during free speech movement. Like you, I learned a lot from FSM. It was something that really taught me something about grassroots and belief in an issue, a principle. When I joined the JACL, I did so very reluctantly because my father was a Kibe. Some of you may know his history. He was one of the people caught in the Manzanar riot. He and Mr. Harry Ueno were very close friends. They both worked in the mess halls. And both Mr. Ueno and my father were taken away by the police during the Manzanar riot because they confronted the administration as on an issue of their stealing some of the provisions that were coming into Manzanar. But I grew up in a very anti-JACL household. You could not mention the word without the wrath of my father. And so when I joined, it was with a lot of reluctance. And my wife told me at one point, you need to call your father and tell him you joined. And it took me, I don't remember, it took me a couple weeks to get up the nerve to call him. And I did, and I said, you know, the only reason I did this is because of redress. And that there's a lot of discussion, there's something happening within the JACL. Alan's right, the JACL was very establishment in the 1970s. The old guard still ran the organization, but what was interesting is that the national director at that point, where I had joined and started becoming active, was a guy named Carl Nobuyuki, who came out of LA. And as I understand it, Carl was part of LRS down there. You probably know whether he was or not. Anyway, he was fairly left in his thinking. The staff was pretty progressive, and we were constantly at war with the old guard. What you have to understand about the organization is that it has, even to this day, this dark cloud that hangs over its head because of 1942 and the leadership decision to cooperate with the government and to counsel the Japanese American community to go to the camps quietly, to cooperate. There are a lot of us who would say that we would never have done that. And perhaps, perhaps not. I don't know. You know, you have to relive that situation. But that was still the group that controlled the JACL when I got involved. I partially got involved in redress because there was a guy named Clifford Ueda, a doctor in Northern California, in San Francisco, also an incredible activist, took on the Sierra Club on his own because of the whaling issue and their position on that, and those kinds of issues. The Ivo Toguri campaign, he led that campaign. Clifford was running for president, and he was running as the redress candidate. And that's what encouraged me about getting more involved in this. And Clifford's the one, when he won the presidency of the organization, who asked me to chair the national committee. Much to the displeasure of the old guard at the convention, because, you know, I was an unknown, and the first thing you could hear going around the convention was, who the hell is John Tateshi? I was young, I had a beard, I had long hair, I didn't fit the image of the JACL, but I thought, you know, I was young enough and arrogant enough to think I knew how to do this. I thought I understood what it would take for us to get something done. It was hard in the community because the young people, the sansei, who were the most energetic in trying to get something going, didn't trust the JSL. And I don't blame them. Had I not been involved, I wouldn't have trusted the JSL. I didn't even trust it being part of it. But I was in a position where I could make decisions and make things happen. And that's what was important. And I realized that without the network in the JSL, nothing was going to happen. And so a lot of what happened in terms of decisions that were made in spite of the old guard. Because I'll tell you quite honestly, within the organization, as I think reflecting the community, most Nisei were really reluctant to undertake this campaign. They didn't want redress. They didn't want this, you know, camp to be brought up again. So it was important for us, those of us who were kind of on the outside, but at the heart of the organization at that point, to move the issue, regardless of what people like Mike Masaoka or Pat Okura or some of the elders would tell us. And Mike's biggest complaint is that every time I would talk to him, I'd ignore what he was saying anyway. And that, you know, there was a lot of truth in that, although Mike had a lot of good advice, but it was a tough issue in the community. It was a hard issue for the community because it took us a few years for people to get on board. And I think that was when the commission announced it was coming to town, that we finally saw a total change occur in the community where everyone said, we need to all come together on this. This is where it's all going to happen. And that is, to me, that was the whole turning point of everything within the community. But, you know, love or hate the organization, it was at the core of the campaign. It did a lot of good things, made some mistakes. And I know that when it came around to the commission hearings, NCRR was much more helpful in the community than JSL chapters. We weren't equipped to do that. We weren't at the grassroots level in the same way. Our thing was push the legislation, push the issue out. And NCRR and the community groups worked the community in a lot more effectively than I think our chapters were able to. So, you know, in the end, it wasn't just one group, one person. It was all of us. We all got involved. That was how this thing got done. It wouldn't have happened otherwise.
John, if I can interrupt, let's use that as a jumping point to get to the commission hearings then. Let it be sufficient to say that at this point, the redress story is not only the story of how legislation was passed, but it really is also the story of how a community went from saying shikata ganai to speaking with one voice and getting along enough to fight for that redress legislation to pass. And certainly, as you're getting a sense of here, not everyone got along. There was distrust within the community, but the community was able to overcome that and move forward. In the interest of time, I'm going to move forward now to the commission hearings, which happened in the early 80s, 81 through 83. And all three of our individuals here were involved in the commission hearing. Aiko was the researcher for the CWRIC. And Aiko, why don't you start off by talking about what it was like from your vantage point and what you did for the commission?
When I started doing the research, I must tell you, I was not a trained researcher. I barely finished high school. Never went to college, so I didn't know the intricacies of doing research. But through trial and error methods, I finally learned about how to go about doing research, especially the National Archives. Many people don't quite understand that National Archives is not like a library. You just don't go there and find a book on the shelves or go to the index cards and say, oh, I think I'll go pick up this book and go to the shelf or the bookcase, pick it up. These are all the kinds of material we were searching for are original documents, original letters, memos, and all that, going way back to 1930s, 40s, when we were trying to find the basis for the decision to remove all of us. And so it took a lot of consultation with archivists who knew the material, asking we had to decide what it is that we wanted to find in order to move forward the investigation for the commission. And so it was a very time-consuming thing, but it was actually very rewarding for me, because after all, I was personally involved in the all the history. But it, I think we, my husband and I, spent several years, 25 years or so, going to the archives, and we got quite familiar with the work, and which is the reason the commission, when I applied for the research position on the commission, since no one else had knowledge of where the material was located that would help to promote the study for the commission, I was hired, and it was a very gratifying experience.
Can you give us some examples of some of the things that you found?
Okay, I guess the, one of the most important things was the report of the Commanding General of the Western Defense Command, General John L. DeWitt, whom we seem to label, we have been labeling him as the, quote, villain, who said a Jap is a Jap, and he's quoted in a press conference as having said that in April 14, 1943, as I recall. But actually, I'm not sure that he had very much up here. But he had, he did have a brilliant lawyer who was assistant chief of staff by the name of Colonel Carl R. Bendetson, who I'm sure did all the thinking for General DeWitt. I'm quite convinced of it because so many of the documents that I found with the General DeWitt's signature on it always had, you know, at the secretaries a long time ago used to write at the very bottom of reports the name of the person who dictated the material and the typist or the secretary. Those of us of my age who were secretaries know what I'm talking about. And I saw so many of the documents that had General DeWitt's Carl Bendetson's signature on it, and his signature on the right-hand top to show he approved it as well. And so I am convinced that he, Colonel Bendetson, was behind a lot of the decisions made by General DeWitt. General DeWitt was previously, before he became commanding general of the Western Defense Command, he was a quartermaster general, and he didn't have any combat experience. Actually, Colonel Bendetson didn't either, but he was a brilliant lawyer. And he claimed, having been born, I think, or brought up in Aberdeen, that he knew the Japanese people. And so, and very few people knew, had grown up with Japanese Americans, especially in the armed forces. And so they were grabbed, people who claimed to know Japanese were grabbed for intelligence and other policy decisions. This included Colonel Bendetson. For me, personally, and actually I had discussed this with Michi Weglin, the author, we considered Colonel Bendetson the culprit and the guilty man rather than General DeWitt, even though General DeWitt had the higher position. At any rate, General DeWitt, his name appears in the final report to the government to justify what the orders he gave for exclusion and incarceration of Japanese Americans. And actually, the first version of this report was printed up only in 10 copies and sent to the War Department in Washington, D.C., and to the Chief of Joint Chiefs of Staff and people in Washington, D.C. This report was totally discredited by the War Department because it showed tremendous bias against the Japanese people, the people of Japanese descent. And also, General DeWitt, on this report, original report, had stated positions that were not in concert with the War Department policy in Washington, D.C. So the higher-ups in Washington, D.C., in the War Department was very angry and said, don't you dare distribute this. You've got to change, make these changes, because we can't have the nation and the international community reading a report that's so racist in nature and that is does not agree with War Department policy. For example, you say in the book that these camps are going to continue throughout the duration of the war. Well, that's not what we want. We want to close these camps before, because we can't have the American government running Japanese American reservations like we're running Native American reservations. We can't afford to do that, so we're going to have to eventually close the camps. But you're saying in the report that we have to keep these camps open to keep these enemy subversive people imprisoned. So anyway, there were lots of little things about the report that the War Department in Washington, D.C. were very angry about and demanded that the General DeWitt make these changes. Well, I happen to have come across these angry notes and telephone conversation transcripts asking for General DeWitt to make alterations in his original report. And so General DeWitt and his staff recalled the copies that had been sent out, the original copies that had been sent out, and were destroyed, except they never could find one copy for some reason, the 10th copy. They couldn't locate it, and there are several memos attesting to the fact. Where's that last 10th copy of the report? And there was a memo that was found that said all the information dealing with the original report of General DeWitt had been destroyed by burning. But it didn't say we never found that 10th copy. And just by luck, I came across that copy. And the only reason I recognized it was because I was familiar with the background of the fact that that 10th copy was lost. And it turned out that the 10th copy belonged to the editor of the Western Defense Command, who helped Colonel Bendetsen and General DeWitt edit, remove, alter the information. And though these notations were on the margins of the pages of the original report that I found, the archivist didn't know the history of this lost 10th copy. So when I mentioned it to him, he said, gee, I'm embarrassed. I didn't know this. So my gosh, Mr. Coffey, that was his name, you can't be expected to know the history of every little piece of paper or book that goes through your desk, because he's been there 25 years and he can't be studying millions. So he was relieved to think that, you know, not very many people knew about this fact. But when I came across this book, I let the Coram Novus people, Dale Minami and the Coram Novus people know about this original report that was used by the Solicitor General in Korematsu, Hirobayashi, as justification. The altered version was used as justification before the Supreme Court by the Solicitor General to say we had to do this because it was in the interest of national security and it was militarily necessary to incarcerate the Japanese people. Okay, so now we found the evidence that the original report was altered, suppressed, and destroyed, evidences of it supposedly destroyed, except fortunately I happened to come across that last copy, which I don't know how they made a mistake, by leaving it in all the papers that were transferred over to the National Archives. And just by sheer luck, I came across it. And by sheer luck, I had just known about it. I had read about this problem a few weeks before, so it was still fresh in my mind. Joy for the Coram Novus case, and actually it helped the NCJAR, about which I'd like to say a word if we have time.
Okay, let me get to the other two, and we'll come back to NCJAR. But I think the story that you share illustrates that you need both good luck and a good memory to be a good archivist. And Eichel certainly was that, because without her memory and her ability to recognize that this book that was literally sitting on an archivist's desk without any kind of indication that that was the 10th copy, she was able to identify that in the moment, and the rest is history. Let's go back to the commission. John, you were a part of that JECL group that met with Matsunaga, Inoue, Mineta, and Matsui when the recommendation was made to create a commission, and then you were there when the commission bill was signed, and were there for many of the commission hearings. What's your memory of that time?
My memory of it? It was an incredible time. As I said, I never thought we'd get a bill through the Congress, certainly not within 2 years of when I launched the campaign. The meeting with the who we call the Big Four, Inoue, Matsunaga in the Senate, Mineta, and Matsui, who was a freshman at that time. He had just entered the House of Representatives. Was a meeting to try to set a direction, because we had all these ideas, and it occurred to us at one meeting that I had of my committee, maybe we ought to talk to those guys, because they're the ones, after all, who are going to have to run these bills. We had a meeting in Washington, and our proposal was a $25,000 and a $3 billion trust fund, and an apology. And we're really enthusiastic about it and said, we want to go with this. This is what we have. And, you know, they had said, tell us what you want and we'll do it. And so we're talking about all this, and through this meeting, about half hour went by, and I noticed Danny Noah hadn't said a word. It was Norm Mineta who was the most gung-ho on this whole idea, and Sparky was, you know, he was equally enthusiastic. And then Danny Noah said, have you fellas thought about a commission? And my heart dropped. I didn't want the commission. I knew he was going to come up with this, but I thought as long as he doesn't say it, we don't have to do it. But he said it, and we were bound by what he was suggesting. And he made a really good point. He said that we know it was wrong. We know the government is guilty, but the American public doesn't know. And he says, I can tell you, sure as hell, my colleagues don't think it was the wrong thing. And every member of Congress just about thinks it was the right thing to do. He said, you need an official record, and you need a report. That was item one. He says, the second thing is you'll get more publicity out of this than you could even begin to afford to pay for. And that was a major consideration, plus the fact that Danny Noah was saying commission. So that's the direction we took. We went to the White House for the signing ceremony. It only took a year to get that bill, and actually less than a year. I was lobbying the House, mainly the House. I ignored the Senate because Inoue and Matsunaga were taking care of the Senate. It's a whole different body. The House is a difficult proposition. So I was working mainly the House, almost daily. And we got the bill through the Congress, and it went to Carter. Carter signed the bill, gave us a signing ceremony, which was really important for us because it was the first time we were going to have a meeting with the president about redress, and that was the first step. The hearings, I'll tell you, that was the most awful thing I've ever gone through. We tried to prepare our community for the hearings. I was working closely with the commissioners on what was going to happen. Paul Bunai at the time was the director of the commission, the staff. And a woman named Joan Bernstein, who was the chief counsel for HHS, somehow wangled the chair of the commission. We all thought it was going to be Arthur Goldberg. They had a private meeting, and I was prepared to go meet with Goldberg, and the word came out, it's Jody Bernstein. And we looked around at each other and thought, who the hell is Jody Bernstein? Never heard of her, other than the fact that she had been appointed. So I was working with the commissioners. I had to promise that I wouldn't talk to anyone on the commission staff. And the only commissioner who wouldn't talk to me was Bill Matutani, because he didn't want to look tainted by the community. That was fine. And so I knew when the hearings were going to start. And the research was starting, and the hearings were scheduled, and I went to every hearing in the lower 48. I didn't go to the Alaska hearings, but I attended every hearing in the lower 48, starting with the one in D.C. and then L.A., San Francisco, etc. It was horrible. It was so emotional and so gut-wrenching. I've never gone through anything like that. I don't think I could go through that again. It's the only time I've ever seen Nisei men cry in public. Not just one or two, almost every one of them who got up to the witness table started talking, and it was so difficult for them. I mean, they were spilling their guts out. They were talking about personal pain, and the commission hearings got so much publicity. I mean, every single hearing got publicity all over the country. The national media picked it up, and the local media picked it up. And Inoue was right. We could not have paid for this kind of publicity. It was unbelievable. And when the report came out, again, the national media covered it. And the plan was we would separate the report from the recommendations by 6 months so that we could get kind of a double whammy on the publicity. They covered the report, and then they came out with the recommendations about 5 months later, and again, the media covered that, the demand and the recommendation, and which was $20,000, of course. I knew at that point we were going to win this thing. We were going to get a bill in the Congress, and we took the language of the recommendations. That was the plan all along. Made that into the bill that was introduced, both the House and the Senate. But at that point, I was pretty sure we were going to win. It was going to take time. It was going to be hard. We were going to have to have the whole community behind us. But I felt really good. I felt that whatever sacrifices people were making for this campaign were really worth it. And there were a lot of personal sacrifices. And there was a lot of belief in the community. The one thing I said to JCL as we launched this thing, we have to enter this campaign without bitterness, without anger, without rancor. This isn't about revenge. It's about making it right. And I think that's how the community saw this whole thing. It wasn't about us. It was about the Constitution. It was about setting the course for this country. I was pleased when the hearings finished, because that was the one thing you heard over and over and over. This isn't about me. This is about America. This is for the country. And over 750 witnesses, except for the likes of Lillian Baker, got up there and made that comment. And it wasn't rehearsed. This was a real, you know, this was kimochi. And it was important, because that ultimately is what that was all about. So I felt great.
Alan, NCRR was very active also in the commission hearings and in recruiting people. What are your memories of the commission hearing?
Well, our initial position was not to support the commission bill. We, to be truthful, thought this is JCL again. They have a wonderful bill, and they want to set up a study commission, and it'll probably be studied for the next 20 years. And they'll come up with a lukewarm recommendation after that. So, but once the commission bill, and John and I, in fact, had debates in community forums about the pros and cons of commission. And in retrospect, I've had to since apologize to John, because that was a wise way to go.
You know, so. I told Ellen when the museum had its dinner a few months ago, I was sitting next to Ellen at the dinner, and I said to him that I really appreciated through all of that when we made that decision, that he never once trashed me, like just about everyone else did. And Ellen was the one person who, if he had done that, it would have made a huge difference. I mean, it would have devastated me. But I always appreciated that. And I told him after 30 years, you know, thanks. I really appreciated that.
Well, what John did not say is John's mother and my mother have remained good friends for over 30 years. And before our debates, my mom would say, now, be nice to Johnny now. You know. But that said, after the commission bill passed, again, NCRR, our principles were on grassroots activism and mobilizing the community, so that we worked to make sure the commission would meet what we felt our community's ends were. So we fought and demanded regional hearings. You know, because our concern was these hearings were going to be, a commission was going to meet in Washington, D.C. There, as typically, you know, commissions do, they were going to invite, quote, experts, scholars, and others to testify. They were going to review research, and then they were going to issue their things. And so we wanted hearings in our communities, We fought for evening testimony so people who were working would be able to attend. We fought for Japanese translation because we wanted to make that accessible. And then what we did is we recruited and trained and prepared testifiers. Because these are people that would not have volunteered to testify before a federal commission. But yet, what I think, and John said, the people that were the most poignant and were those who were not scholars, you know, were not lawyers. These were individuals who were truck drivers, gardeners, others who spoke from their heart of their own personal experience. And that was so persuasive and so powerful. And it meant so much more to have individuals who could speak genuinely of what they experienced, what the impact was on their lives, as opposed to the researchers that could give numbers and, you know, conclusions, etc. And so I agree with John. It was a turning point. At that point, after those hearings, etc., that became the dinner table conversation in so many families talking about that. And you have to understand, in history, before those commission hearings, it was not a slam dunk that redress was being supported in the Japanese American community. In fact, when I got involved in redress, one of my aunts disowned me. You know, she thought, that's history, you're rocking the boat, you know, we've made it, we're good citizens, so we shouldn't be doing things like that, and you're bringing shame to our family, you know. But after the commission hearings, it became something where I think the denial that had occurred for decades suddenly turned into righteous indignation. And an understanding that, one, it was not our fault, and that as a community, we should share what we had. And I think that's what really was the turning point to me, is the community began to understand it's okay to talk about this. It's okay to say that you were wronged. And this is not being disloyal, and it's not the time to be the quiet American. Another JACL slogan, by the way. Thank you.
Gee, you ought to join JACL.
Alan. I've been given the sign that we have less than 10 minutes, and we have so much more to cover, and unfortunately, we're not going to cover it all. But if you could say a few words about the 1987 lobbying trip that the NCRR conducted and that you were instrumental in.
Well, again, I should say, and if you read Mitch's book, you get a sense, we all had very different approaches to accomplishing redress, but the fact that we worked together on all of this and it all came together is a testament to our community. And I think for all of the organizations and individuals that are involved in this, having the end goal in mind as opposed to organization or individual egos. And so that said, we organized a lobbying delegation to Washington, D.C. We had about 120 people that participated. And we're relatively naive. You know, we didn't spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. And so our initial thinking, and this is NCRR, is we said, you know, some of us, we're thinking at this time, maybe 10 or 15, we're going to spend our vacations in Washington, D.C., so let's coordinate when we're going to spend our vacation, you know. And so we were just going to go there together as a group and start, you know, naively kind of knocking on doors, et cetera. But it took off so that by the time that the delegation occurred in July, there was like 120 people. And that's when I also got a sense about, this was in 1987, and so that's when you got a sense about how important redress was by who came out, but most importantly, the kind of reception that we received in Washington, D.C. amongst elected officials. And again, I can only talk about what we brought together were not professional lobbyists that were, quote, representing this group. These were people that were most directly impacted, veterans, war resistors, others. And I think we sat in and met, I think, how many offices did we visit? I don't know. Over 100 congressional and Senate offices where we had delegations. And I think, again, I'm naively very, you know, saying, I think what was impressive was that these were regular community folks who paid their own way. They weren't getting paid to do this. They obviously were not prepped, you know, and kind of rehearsed. These were people that, again, and all we told them was speak from the heart, share your experience, and say why redress is so important. You know, and it's because they, you know, they say, well, I'm going to be talking to Congress. And they said, speak from your heart, share your experience. That will come through. And I think it was an important kind of chapter, and again, in our communities becoming empowered to share our stories, to tell our stories, and understand if we're going to truly be empowered, we can't necessarily rely on lobbyists and elected officials, et cetera, that we have to, as Adam Schrager said, we have to take it in our own hands to become empowered and do the right thing.
If any of you want more information on that lobbying trip, in the audience we have some members from the NCRR, Susie Katsuda and Kay Ochi, and I know Kay was very influential, and being behind the scenes and organizing who would go see whom. So afterwards, if you want to speak to either of them, they're in the second row up here. I've been given the five-minute sign. I got asked this last question because I want to wrap it up with your ideas on this. What is the legacy of redress for our nation? The fact that the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 did not include all that were incarcerated, namely Japanese Latin Americans were left out. The fact that in the war on terrorism that we're facing right now, people who look different, who appear to be different, their civil liberties are oftentimes trampled upon. What lessons do we take from redress that we can apply today to all of these groups that are facing their various struggles? I'll throw it out to you all.
Well, I'll just
go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, I think redress is very significant and very important. I think all of you here know that. And I think it helped to kind of strengthen the civil liberties foundation of our nation. And I think it set the record once and for all. I think Dale said that this morning, you know, about what happened to us was wrong, the causes of it, and it should not happen again. So I think redress is very important to that degree. But also what's so clear at this time is we have a nation with a very short memory. You know, and unless these lessons continue to be shared and we don't learn from them, and, you know, again, you can obviously know my political leanings already, so this is not going to shock you, you know, but for those of you that believe so much in the redress campaign and fought as part of that, to not be deeply offended by the actions of the Bush administration in the last 8 years since, you know, since 9/11 is scary. If you saw redress as something more than just a Japanese-American story, if you saw it as something that was to defend civil liberties and civil rights, you must be obscenely offended by what is going on today in terms of the assault upon civil liberties under the guise of national security. And so I wish I could be more optimistic and say it's a wonderful time, but I would rather focus on those in the audience and say those of us that know redress and fought for so hard for it, if we really believe in what we fought so hard for, we have to understand we have to step forward at this time. The scary thing for me is that the issue of civil liberties and civil rights is not on the national political agenda. You know, neither Barack Obama or John McCain are really dealing with any of these things. They feel somehow if you support the defense of civil liberties and civil rights that somehow you are weak on defense and weak on national security. And I would argue that we have to reframe the debate to be able to say, you know, you can talk about the 104 tortillas, whatever, that you do not have to be weak on defense and security, and you can still affirm civil liberties and civil rights. If anything, that's what we're fighting these things for, is to defend civil liberties and civil rights. But the agenda and the dialogue is not occurring on a national stage, and I think we have to kind of assume some responsibility to try to push that so it is part of the national dialogue.
Yeah. From my personal experience, I was the director of the JSL, national director at the time of 9/11, and I mobilized the JSL chapters around the country to help protect the Arab and Muslim communities. And I was dealing with the Congress. I can tell you unequivocally that there were two things that were really significant and important as preventative tools for what was being thought of in Congress in 2002. One was the commission report, and the other was the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. I talked to a number of members of Congress and reminded them that in 1942, the government took the actions it did based on rumors, based on no specific evidence, the fear that those among us are a danger to the public safety. And I said, you know, I was a three-year-old kid at the time. You explained to me why I was a danger to America, why I spent my 3 years in prison. And I said that there were 120,000 Japanese Americans in 1942 living on the West Coast. There are over 1 million people we're talking about today, Arab and Muslim, in the United States. You don't want 20 years from now them coming back to you with my organization backing them, seeking redress for some stupid thing you're about to do without evidence, without any specific trials or anything that would justify the action you're talking about. You can't say to me but we need to be safe. There are terrorists among us. I said, there are. There are probably thousands of them. And they all look like people like Timothy McVeigh. And you need to start thinking about what you're doing and why you're thinking the way you're thinking. There is no evidence out there. And I said, and if they come back to you 20 years from now, not only are you going to look stupid, but it's going to cost this government billions and billions of dollars. I said, 120,000 of us, it costs $2 billion. And I said, just think, if you talk about in terms of a million. I think the legacy of redress is to secure the future for this country. It's really important. And I agree completely with what Alan is saying. We should be terribly offended by the kind of thinking that's been going on for the last 7 years in this country, because it's been outrageous. And, you know, as people who have gone through this experience, I think it's incumbent on us to try to do what we can in our own personal ways to stop this kind of madness in this country. I don't know if it's going to stop whoever gets elected next, but it's really important to continue to tell the story. I was in Ohio 2 weeks ago doing a one-week institute on the internment to teachers, because it's now on the Ohio standards for social study. The internment is part of the lesson of the state of Ohio. Without redress, it wouldn't be there. It's the reason this is happening all over the country. So it's important that we hold conferences like this, that we keep thinking about redress. And despite the young people saying to us, Yonsei saying, you know, you old guys, you can't stop talking about camp. You damn right we can't, because it's important to talk about camp and to tell the story. It's your story, and you need to tell it.
Aiko, as it should be, you have the last word.
I don't think we have enough time.
No, we don't.
The sign, only 3 minutes left.
That's okay. You go ahead and talk.
Well, I didn't get a chance to talk about the National Council for Japanese American Redress. Okay?
You
oh, so, so here. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to do a striptease, but I'm going to show you this T-shirt. Here. You will recognize it, perhaps. It was... Thank you. It was the symbol for the redress movement. It was designed by Frank Fuji of Seattle, a wonderful artist. And he took artist's liberty to change Ichi-ni-san, as you all know, one, two, three, third generations. He changed the position of the writing, the calligraphy a little bit, to show there were three generations of us in the camps. Here's the fence. And here are the barbed wires. And I think it's very symbolic. The artist gave us gave Jack and me permission to copyright this. And I noticed everybody's using it. As long as it's used for the redress movement, it's perfectly fine with us. You know, you don't have to ask our permission, as long as it's used for that purpose. I just wanted to show this off to you. I'm sure you recognize it.
Here.
Okay.
Before we close, I wanted to acknowledge some people in the audience, because, again, at this conference, you have the opportunity to meet with people like these three individuals who made history, who made redress happen. Dale, if you could stand up in the back, please. Dale Minami. You all saw him this morning. Lead counsel on the Korematsu case. Bombard him with questions. Ask him. Take advantage of his being here. Kay, Ochi, Susie Katsuta, please stand. Please stand. Members of the NCRR, people who made that happen. Yosh Kurumiya, please stand. Yosh, stand. Yosh was involved with the NCJAR, the National Council of Japanese American Redress class action suit that Aiko didn't get a chance to talk about, but which was a class action suit that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Certainly a wealth of knowledge there. Paul Sunishi, Paul, please stand. Yes, please stand, Paul.
Where is he?
Where is he? I'm okay, I saw him earlier. I don't see him here now. But again, there are people here in the audience who know and who are part of the redress movement. So, John, Aiko, Alan, We didn't have enough time. I apologize. We needed 4 hours to hear your stories. But again, I would like to thank you on behalf of the Japanese American National Museum for coming here today and sharing our stories. And please, folks, come up and ask them all the questions you can. Thank you for being here.
And if you want to continue the conversation, there will be